This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Coming up in the program, COVID-19 is surging, and some are calling for required vaccinations, including some students at the University of Wyoming.
I think we desperately need the vaccines to be mandated, because otherwise there's no way to be sure that we're all safe.
We will also get an update on the COVID-19 challenges in Teton County. In Laramie, houses are scarce, and the houses that are available are often unaffordable.
Without a visible path to housing, it's very hard for these businesses making large capital decisions to make a move into a community.
And it's been a record hot summer, and that's causing some Mountain Westerners to change their way of life, or at least the way they cool their home.
I'm ready for AC. I haven't had it before. I give.
It's coming up next on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Teton County is the most highly vaccinated county in the state, but at the time of year when the population in the community expands, COVID-19 rates are high. This week, Teton County says it has met the CDC's red level for high-risk transmission. County Public Health Response Coordinator Rachel Wheeler says they are trying to be transparent about the risk level.
We're trying to just streamline and align with the CDC so people can still go to our dashboard and see what risk level we're in. And at this time, especially with the Delta variant and people having been able to get COVID vaccines, you know, we're in a new place, but also kind of a similar place than we were last year. And we do feel that looking at transmission or the spread of COVID-19 in the community allows people to take the proper precautions, preventative measures, or make decisions about themselves and their families when they decide to do different activities.
I know a number of counties are probably going to be resistant to mask mandates. You have been a little more aggressive up in Teton County over the time. What do you anticipate might be forthcoming?
You know, at this time, we're just looking at the data every day. And we are at this point encouraging community members to wear masks in public indoor spaces. That's the same guidance that the CDC is giving out. And I don't know what we'll see in the coming weeks, but that's what I know now.
Rachel Wheeler again visiting with us. Let me ask you just a little bit about where some of the transmission is coming from. I don't want to blame outsiders, but I'm curious with all the tourists that you have in Teton County, is that maybe what the problem area might be because you have so many folks vaccinated up there?
Yeah, well, we do. So we look at the total number of COVID-19 cases that we receive in Teton County, and then we separate that out from community members and then also people who are not community members that tested positive. That could include, we have a lot of workers who don't technically live in Teton County, but may have tested up here while they're at work. We do have visitors and then just others who are testing here. So it's hard to say if it's just visitors, but I can say that we are still seeing a lot of COVID-19 cases in our community, and community members are spreading it to other community members. It's really hard to say if this is a chicken or an egg scenario, because our community members are also traveling themselves. So it's hard to say if this is just a visitor problem or a resident problem.
It's amazing to me when you see your numbers and you look at the vaccination rate. Have you scratched your head on this one as well?
It's always a head scratch, I think. You know, things are constantly changing. I would say the Delta variant has definitely made things more interesting, especially because studies are showing that people have a much higher viral load. What we are seeing, though, is that even if a vaccinated individual tests positive, their viral load for COVID-19 drops really quickly compared to those who are unvaccinated. And our epidemiologist ran some numbers for us yesterday. And at this point, you're two times more likely to test positive for COVID-19 if you're unvaccinated than someone who is vaccinated. And we are seeing that people who are vaccinated, yes, you may get sick, but just to remind everyone, you know, the goal of these vaccines was really to make sure it made it so people aren't dying from COVID or needing to be hospitalized from COVID. And we are seeing that from the vaccine.
Rachel, maybe one last thing for you as you sort of see the change in population coming into Teton County. I know in the fall, you'll tend to get older people like myself that travel up your way. That population has tended to be a little more vaccinated. And I mean, do you anticipate that the numbers will go down, or are you not sure?
From what we're seeing around the country with the Delta variant, I expect that our cases may continue to climb for a little longer until they drop. Teton County school districts will be starting in a couple of weeks, and that'll be interesting to see if we get more cases in younger students once that starts. But I would say we all know the preventative measures to do to try to reduce our case counts, and that's wear a mask in public indoor settings. Please stay home if you're sick and get tested. That's really the only way to know if you have COVID-19 or if you have just a cold.
Again, nice to visit with Rachel Wheeler from the Teton County Health Department. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
This week, the University of Wyoming is requiring masks to be worn indoors as students and faculty return to campus. Many faculty urged UW trustees to pass the requirement, but many also wanted to have the university take an additional step of requiring employees and students to get a vaccine. Wyoming Public Radio's Adlin Jamaluddin talked with some students on campus about their thoughts on if the university should go another step and make vaccinations mandatory.
Hi, my name is Cade Friels, and I support mandatory vaccinations for students on campus. Mandatory vaccinations are the best way to keep students, faculty, and staff safe on campus.
James Lilly, I think we desperately need the vaccines to be mandated, because otherwise there's no way to be sure that we're all safe, and I think the president and everyone on the board of trustees are cowards for not doing it yet, because none of them have to be here on campus TAing or being around students, so there's really no risk to them, but they'd rather see people die than lose out on another year of tuition.
Hi, my name is Afik Sohaimi. I think the reason why vaccine should be mandated is because that's the only way we know we can ensure that people are safe.
Taryn Bradley. I think that mandatory vaccinations are really within the spirit and the heart of our University of Wyoming values and even cowboy community. I think that a mandatory vaccination would make it so that we can ensure the safety and health of our students, faculty, and staff, which I think is something that we should really honor and value here at the university.
Jordan Bartlett, I think vaccines need to be mandated. I think that the university would rather some students die than lose money. As someone who has to TA, to be able to make money and stay here, I have to be around undergraduate students, and I don't know if people are vaccinated.
Kinsey Hine. When I think of the vaccines, and especially making them mandatory, I like to think of it as protection, because vaccines have just always protected us since they've been created. You know, we don't have to worry about things like chickenpox, the measles, polio, because we have gotten a hold of and tamped down on those diseases because of vaccines. So I like to think of vaccines as protection. And so obviously the more people we can have vaccinated at the University of Wyoming, the more protected people will be, especially those who, you know, can't get the vaccine for medical reasons or are immunocompromised, who really need other people to support them in this fight against COVID-19.
That story was produced by Adlin Jamaluddin. Those who oppose vaccinations and mask mandates said they prefer not to talk on tape or be identified. When we come back, we'll return to the Mountain West News Bureau series on tribal jails. This is Open Spaces.
A startup is trying to save the planet by developing a special technology. And it could all come together if they manage to win an international competition. It's gonna be tough, but folks think this CEO is the guy to do it.
I don't have a good way to put this that doesn't sound cheesy, but kind of like this mythical dude that like just out there to just like be rad and just spread stoke.
Binge all of Carbon Valley now. Listen at carbonvalleypodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Federal correctional facilities, including federal prisons and ICE detention centers, must have trained medical personnel on site. However, that is not the case for the more than 70 tribal jails overseen by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Our investigation from the Mountain West News Bureau found that the lack of doctors or nurses on staff can have deadly results. For instance, when a 33-year-old mother of four was arrested for stealing two beers at a gas station on the Blackfeet Reservation of Montana, she needed medical help, but that didn't happen. As part of our Pulitzer Center-supported series on tribal jails, Nate Hedgie reports.
Keith Skunk Cap's grief began with a phone call. He was out bowling with some friends on a Thursday night in Cutbank, Montana. He was having a good time, grabbing a beer at the bar, when his cell phone rang.
I get a call from my brother Raymond, and he tells me that my sister's gone. I said, you better be lying.
But he wasn't. Keith's sister, Brandy Skunk Cap, had just died in the federally operated jail on the nearby Blackfeet Reservation.
I broke down, and I was like, this can't be true, you know.
Brandy was Keith's little sister. A shy, slight woman with brown hair. When she was a little kid, she loved drawing pictures of eagles and horses. But as she got older, she fell into an addiction to painkillers, methamphetamine, and alcohol. When she lost custody of her four kids, her family says she took a turn for the worse. Keith's wife, Tara Braun.
We could tell it was taking a toll on her body. You can just tell by looking at her. But
what did she look like?
Very small, very frail.
Hair is falling out.
Yeah. Teeth were falling out, not the Brandy that we were used to seeing.
It was this Brandy that was arrested on March 23rd, 2016. Her skin was jaundiced, and 2 weeks prior, she had been in a hospital vomiting blood. She told guards she didn't feel well. The BIA's health and safety standards say guards are supposed to note these ailments on an inmate's intake forms. If a person is sick, they need to be taken to a health clinic. But the correctional officer on duty decided Brandy was healthy enough to stay in the jail.
This lady is really sick.
That's David Mathis. He's a physician and surgeon who specializes in correctional health care. He's also an expert witness in correctional medicine. He reviewed Brandy's jail records, autopsy, and the coroner's report obtained by the Mountain West News Bureau. He says the guards screwed up.
They needed to contact the hospital where she was vomiting blood and find out, get that discharge summary, and get some medical professional involved, because this was a very sick lady and needed different drugs to support her.
But she never got those drugs. She never visited a hospital. The next day, Brandy had what appeared to be an alcohol withdrawal seizure as her cellmate watched helplessly. It was captured on surveillance video, but guards missed it. And when they checked on her nearly an hour later, she was unresponsive. Guards had violated at least two federal policies here. First, when they failed to check on her regularly and missed the seizure. Then again, when they found her. Instead of giving her immediate first aid, it took 6 minutes before a tribal police officer showed up and began performing CPR. Brandy's sister-in-law, Tara Braun.
She needs help. She needs medical attention. And it was not, they didn't respond to her until it was too late.
Brandy was taken to a hospital where she was pronounced dead about 2 hours after first having the seizure. She's one of at least five inmates at tribal jails who have died after guards failed to provide proper medical care and attention. Tribal advocate Brandy Tomhav is a former congressional staffer and member of the Choctaw Nation. She lobbies on behalf of tribes on Capitol Hill. She says the BIA needs to start requiring on-site nurses, paramedics, or doctors at these jails.
You have folks coming in who are being confined without knowing what kinds of infectious disease, chronic conditions, or persistent injuries that they have.
She says that's a recipe for deadly mistakes. The federal government funds healthcare providers in other correctional programs, but chose not to require them in the BIA's tribal jails.
Choices have consequences, and the federal government has chosen to ignore their legal obligation to provide appropriate staffing and programming in the form of medical care inside tribal jails. And that decision has gotten people killed.
But beyond the lack of doctors or nurses at these jails, our investigation has also uncovered that some of the jails themselves are squalid and unsafe. They don't have potable water. The walls are cracked. The heaters are broken. That story in the final part of our series. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie.
Tribes across the region ceded millions of acres of land to the federal government in exchange for services like education, healthcare, and public safety. That's what's known as the federal government's trust responsibility, and it includes funding more than 70 correctional facilities on reservations across the country. But many of those facilities are in deep disrepair. In this last story in our series on tribal jails, the Mountain West News Bureau's Savannah Marr spent time with the director of some of those facilities.
For decades, the Shiprock Jail in the northeastern part of the Navajo Nation has been deteriorating.
We're looking here at a 62-year-old tribal building.
Dolores Grayeyes heads up the Navajo Department of Corrections. It closed this jail back in March, citing unsafe conditions and a lack of funding from the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Our need is probably between 14 and 16 million.
That's to operate all six of the Navajo Nation's jails.
We get 6 million a year to run the adult facilities.
So the system is funded at less than half of its actual need. Grayeyes wants to show me what that shortfall looks like on the ground. The building is empty and cavernous without inmates. Our voices echo off the concrete walls, which are cracked in places and covered with chipping blue and pink paint. The air is stale. Some rooms smell like mold, others smell metallic.
Kind of sulfur, rust, a mixture of some sewer kind of smell, you know, old. Oh my God, I'm sick.
That smell is due in part to a faulty ventilation system, which also prevents staff from regulating the temperature.
I've come here during summertime and I just feel that heat and that moisture.
Lately, there had been issues with the plumbing. During the pandemic, the jail had to turn to charities to provide bottled drinking water for the inmates. And the safety and security infrastructure isn't up to modern standards. Multiple inmates have escaped from the jail over the years. Grayeyes says the old-fashioned bars on the cells have allowed several to attempt suicide.
Oh yeah, see these bars? Anybody can wrap something over and then just jump down and hang themselves.
Grayeyes says her department's requests for federal funding to address those issues went unfulfilled.
It's a constant battle, continuously fighting for money.
Grayeyes considers the jail at Shiprock to be beyond repair. She says the BIA needs to fund the construction of a brand new facility here. But she's not holding her breath. And there's a reason for that pessimism. Around 150 miles southwest of Shiprock, the Hopi Reservation has been without a correctional facility since the BIA condemned its jail back in 2016. The tribe's chairman, Timothy Nivangyoma, told a congressional committee recently that the tribe keeps hitting brick walls as it tries to solve the problem.
We fought for funding to replace the facility. which was secured in 2017. However, since that time, there's been no broken ground, only broken promises.
Nevang Yauma says the Hopi community hasn't been truly safe in the 5 years it's been without a jail.
Law enforcement had to transport prisoners to jails 80 miles away, which took officers off the reservation for several hours. The tribe requested assistance from BIA headquarters in Congress, but things continued to get worse.
Shiprock is facing the same problem now. With its jail closed, inmates need to be driven more than 100 miles south to be booked into the Navajo Nation's Crown Point Correctional Center.
Control, can you open up cell 1 and cell 5, please?
Despite the long drive, some inmates are likely glad to be transported here. The Crown Point Jail was built in 2013. It's clean and well-ventilated.
Even the smell is good.
It has a modern security system, a library, classrooms, a gymnasium, and an outdoor rec area for inmates. But the BIA didn't pay to build this facility. The Navajo Nation did it themselves after the old Crown Point Jail fell into disrepair. Gray Eyes says the tribe was backed into a corner after years of underfunding by the BIA.
This is ideal. This is what we want to be able to provide the people that come to stay with us. Again, I can't say enough about how the new facilities really make the environment different for the inmates that come in through the facility.
Gray Eyes would like to replicate this environment at all six of the Navajo Nation's jails, including the jail at Shiprock. But she says it's the BIA's responsibility to fund the construction of safe, modern facilities. She sees the Crown Point Center as a symbol of a tribal correction system that's not broken, just starved of the funding it's owed. After months of written questions and public records requests from NPR and the Mountain West News Bureau, an Interior Department spokesperson said the agency is now planning a comprehensive review of the Tribal Detention Center program. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Savannah Marr.
When we come back, the lack of affordable housing is a growing issue in Wyoming, and today we look at the situation in Laramie. This is Open Spaces.
The Modern West Podcast, audio storytelling with a finger on the pulse of the West.
That was the last wolf that Dad had heard of in the valley.
Journey into a morphing world.
It's all because property. Of the coal mine. Yeah. I mean, it was a good living.
Where old stereotypes fall apart.
All right, Gladys, are we ready to give that girl their scars?
And you get to be yourself. Binge episodes now at themodernwest.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. By just about any measure, Laramie is experiencing a housing crisis. There are not enough homes available. The homes that are available are too expensive, and rental prices are high. Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor reports all of this hurts the local economy.
Laramie is unique for Wyoming. It's the state's only university town. One out of five people there lives in poverty, and a full half of its population are renters. But there's one thing it shares with just about everywhere in the U.S., a housing crisis.
Unfortunately, this is a national problem.
That's Laramie's mayor, Paul Weaver. He and the rest of the city council have met multiple times throughout the summer, digging into the city's housing problems. Much of that has involved looking at economic and housing studies conducted since 2015. There's actually quite a lot of them, from private consulting firms, from the Wyoming Business Council, and from the city itself.
All of them have indicated to us that Laramie has an insufficient supply of housing. And what housing we do have is well outside of what our economy can really bear. In other words, the cost of housing isn't commensurate with the wages here, and it's also not even the kind of housing that people have suggested to us that they want.
For example, the city's 2015 housing study called for 1,500 new housing units by 2020. So far, the city has seen just a third of that. Laramie would have no ability to build housing on its own, so it has to make it profitable for developers to build affordable housing. This could mean changing city code to encourage smaller homes over larger ones, ones that the average person could afford.
Sometimes when you say affordable housing, people get the wrong idea. It conjures up all kinds of unfair imagery. What we're talking about is housing affordability in general. When we say affordable housing, we mean housing that people that are working full-time, trying to raise families here, can afford to purchase and live in.
The lack of affordable housing and starter homes has real economic consequences. Brad Enzi runs the Laramie Chamber Business Alliance and works on recruiting businesses to set up shop in the Laramie area.
I started this job in 2018, and then one of my very first businesses came in to visit, had lunch. They were excited about Laramie, ready to move here. After lunch, somebody in the car pulls up realtor.com. There was like, you know, 9 or 15 listings on the market. And they said, well, we have 20 employees. They couldn't all come and get a house here.
If that company doesn't move here, it means there are 20 fewer people spending money in Laramie businesses.
Without a visible path to housing, it's very hard for these businesses making large capital decisions to make a move into a community. So it puts us at a disadvantage for recruiting.
Enzi says city code changes are a long-term play. Some solutions in the shorter term could also include sweetening the deal for developers by, for example, publicly funding the city infrastructure developers usually have to pay for, such as road improvements. Another problem is the rental market. Half of Laramie rents their home, and it's difficult for them to find a good place to live. Adam Huck has lived in Laramie for nearly a decade, renting from a variety of landlords and property management groups.
In my experience, there's always been some available, but a lot of the ones that end up being available when people are in a sudden need for them are either really run down and not in a condition that most people want to live in, or they're way too outpriced.
Huck wants more city oversight of the rental market, and he wants renters to know their rights. Huck has drafted a document that suggests the city enforce current rules, conduct regular unit inspections, and provide for mediation between renters and landlords. The document he's come up with, one that he's passed around the Laramie bar scene for feedback, doesn't really entail radical changes. But Huck says it's not radical changes that are needed.
I think one of the biggest issues is access to information.
Huck says there's a power and knowledge differential between renters and landlords, and renters often don't know their rights or how to assert them. Unsurprisingly, his document has gotten pushback.
It's not necessarily politically appetizing, what I'm looking at, because, you know, it does put a lot of pressure on a class of people in this town that do have a lot of power. The landlords have shown that they can group together and swing the council politics in a way that does favor them.
This happened in 2019, when the city considered a motion to further discuss rental regulations. Landlords, but not renters, showed up to the meeting, and the proposal was squashed. All of this is unfortunate for renters like Huck, but it also has an impact on the rest of the housing market. As Mayor Weaver puts it, people purchasing single-family homes and dividing them into 3 or 4 cheap rental units puts a squeeze on the availability of middle-range and starter homes that could otherwise be bought by the families and employees the city hopes to recruit.
Any place where there's a hot rental market, housing affordability is terrible.
There's myriad issues facing housing in Laramie. While the last decade has seen those issues grow worse, Weaver says it's not a hopeless situation, that public and private actors just need to be committed to righting the ship.
I think we can do it. I think it's a matter of all the necessary elements coming together. That's probably going to take longer than any of us would like.
For Wyoming Public Radio, this is Jeff Victor.
Every year, Audubon Rockies hosts a BioBlitz somewhere in Wyoming. The event brings together scientists, naturalists, and the general public to catalog as many species of insects, animals, and plants in a particular area. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler brings us this postcard.
Yeah, I caught a crawfish!
We are at the Britain Museum near Bighorn, Wyoming, and we are bioblitzing. My name is Jacqueline Downey. I am the Education Programs Manager for Audubon Rockies. Basically a big race against the clock to survey as many plants and animals as we can find on the surrounding grounds and just right on Little Goose Creek. we get to go, we're going to hike, we're going to get our hands wet and dirty and find out how they survey for fish. We will follow some University of Wyoming scientists and learn how it is that they learn about the different herps, which are reptiles and amphibians. You know, how do they find out what's happening with them? We're going to be learning from some native plant societies. How, you know, what kind of plants are here? What makes them unique?
A dragonfly? Excellent! Bring it over. We'll identify it.
My name is Melanie Torres, and I am a PhD researcher with the University of Wyoming. We just went over some of the basics of insects and insect identification, and we're now just walking around just trying to catch insects and showing the public and folks that are around here what lives around here.
And you also have a, I'm just going to carefully move my hand because you also have a parasitic wasp, so it looks like out here. Fun fact, it was right by my arm, go figure. So let's put this there. Let's put this guy right.
Wasp, would he bite you?
Right now what we're doing is kind of sweep netting, and so we take nets that are usually mesh or canvas, and we are just walking around sweeping in a sweep-like fashion. You're just kind of moving the net along in the grass and picking up the insects as you go that are just hanging out in the grass or jumping around in the grass.
So for this night walk, we are kind of just walking around identifying a whole bunch of different critters and creatures from the, there's some turkeys. Looking for things like turkeys, looking for birds like nighthawks, listening for bats even, and also identifying some fun insects, plants, and essentially we're kind of getting started on the BioBlitz with IDs and keep getting our ears and eyes in tune to what we're hoping to find for tomorrow.
You got a frog!
My name's Julie Reeder. I'm the executive director of Science Kids in Sheridan.
My background is basically a general ecologist, but I've been studying birds since I was a tiny tot. If any of you here in this group have expertise or have knowledge, the whole goal of BioBlitz is just simply catalog as much as we possibly can for this location and get it down on paper. So that said, our first stop for BioBlitz for this group is to walk the creek trail
as we go along.
So right now I'm hearing western wood peewees. They're making their daytime call. They sound like peewee. It's really kind of a hoarse sound, that one. And on the barn, a very large colony of nesting birds. So this one up here, what do you see in terms of its coloration? Or dark and light. Yeah, very dark. But can you see a difference in the color on the front leading part of the wing versus the tail? Can you catch it?
See? Oh yeah, he's there.
I'm looking. I am. Is he within distance of my net?
No.
There he is.
Oh, he's gone.
Oh, that's
crawling
up on the island. Is that a slider?
But this is a western painted turtle. So it's one of our three aquatic species in the state. And they get the name painted because, as you can see, they're beautifully colored.
You see all of our staff.
Yeah.
It can be the biggest challenge, but also the biggest benefit by traveling around to a new part of the state each year, because every location is different. But we get to really shine a light on a new location every time. You know, why is the Britain and the grounds here so special?
It's a fawn. It's a little fawn.
Is it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You look small.
While we're here, I'm going to point out the osprey nest. We put a platform up there. And so for the last several years...
It's kind of neat to know that, you know, there are other people out there that like these things. I hear a lot, like, I can't wait to nerd out at BioBlitz and get really excited about all these plants and animals. And, I mean, I know I look forward to it. I like to learn from different people and, you know, what they know. So many people in Wyoming have such a breadth of knowledge about the plants and animals. And this is a way that everybody can benefit from all that knowledge.
That was an audio postcard from this year's BioBlitz from Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler. Over the summer, the first two women were granted tenure in soil sciences at the University of Wyoming. Dr. Karen Vaughn and Dr. Linda Von Diepen have dedicated time to looking at what diversity looks like in their field. Wyoming Public Radio's Ivy Engel sat down with both of them to discuss why the soil sciences field has historically had diversity difficulties. Dr. Vaughn starts on women's participation in the field.
So we're seeing a lot of women in soil science at this point. If we look at graduate students in soil science, it's up above half of typical male-female gender demographics. So the women are here. They're in graduate school. We're not seeing them matriculate into the careers quickly, and that's absolutely understandable because there are people in those positions. People are retiring and moving through. So there will be a lag in seeing women in those positions. And so we're starting to see those numbers change, but they're not mirroring the numbers of women in those disciplines. And so there's something happening out there. Why? I don't think it's that simple, you know? I mean, there's so many different confounding issues. Is it a hostile work environment? Is it not supportive for parents? All of those things come into play when we think about women in the workforce. Having that role model, that mentor. I have never taken a soil science course from a woman. You know, think about it. I had to think about it. What about you, Linda?
Yeah, so within my education pathway, career pathway, it wasn't until my postdoc that there were really women in the soil sciences field. And so my last postdoc mentor was a female, and she was teaching soil science. I think, yeah, there has definitely been an increase. But as Karen already mentioned, there might be a lag period. And hopefully, yeah, we'll start to see a lot more of those come into either academia or other positions.
So we're graduating a lot of women in the soil sciences with master's degrees, with PhDs, and with bachelor's degrees. You know, we didn't think there were a lot of women soil scientists in academia, in, you know, the higher levels of the federal government. And so we performed this study across the country looking at gender demographics. And gender is one part of diversity. I want to make that clear that there's a lot of other things going on. But in terms of traditional gender norms of male-female, there's 36% of assistant professors in the United States in soil science are women. As we move up into associate professors, that's 24%. And then full professors is 18%, followed by department heads and chairs is 13%. It's not surprising. None of this was surprising. It's just we didn't actually know what the numbers were. We needed a baseline. And so that in 10 years, we can look back and say, okay, how have these efforts impacted these numbers?
So in general, how diverse is the field of soil sciences? You know, taking into account gender identity, race, everything, does it have a lot of work to do?
I think we asked those same questions, and we had a hunch that it wasn't that great, but we didn't have those data. So that's why we also did some research and wrote another paper about diversity in general. And it turns out our hunch was correct. And there's very low diversity in terms of gender diversity, ethnic diversity, cultural, sexual orientation, sexual identity, socioeconomic status. We tried to get to many of those different diversity categories. And yeah, it's not looking great. But that means there's room for improvement. And that means now that we know, we can do targeted work to focus on those populations and increase the diversity.
Yeah. Yeah. My former postdoc advisor, she organized a workshop as well on diversity from all aspects, basically. And again, I think it is interesting that it is the female soil scientists that are approaching those important aspects to increase the diversity within the field of soil science. So we care about that.
Right. Very often it's us, but to all the male soil scientists out there listening, we need you too. And I know you know that, and it may feel uncomfortable and it may feel weird. And you're like, I am a cisgendered white man. I can't, how am I going to increase diversity? Well, you can be an advocate and you can be a mentor. So there's a place for everybody.
What can be done about increasing diversity?
One big thing that can be done is putting value on the act of focusing on diversity and the importance, because a diverse set of scientists is a better functioning, more effective, more creative, more thoughtful, and really just a better, well-oiled machine. Is to have those diverse ideas and people thinking differently and coming from different places. And so if, you know, the powers that be can, you know, put some value towards those of us that work in those realms, I think it's a lot about mentors and seeing someone that looks like you, or seeing someone that cares about you or advocates for you in ways that maybe other people as scientists weren't taught to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very true. And I know from a lot of the job ads that are currently out there, or like I've been involved in the hiring, they ask specifically for a diversity statement. So I think to make people think about it, at least instead of just focusing on what their research is, what they've done, and even just like broader impacts, I think to include that at least makes them think about that. And from that, there can be more ideas rolling out of that to improve that, especially in the particular field where diversity is low.
But I will say, as an assistant professor, when you've got everything's up in the air and you are trying to put out fires and do all the different research projects and teach really, really well, connect with your students, it's hard. It's hard unless there's value put on that type of work. And so it's extra. It's always extra.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So not putting it all on the professor, but going beyond that as well. Yes, I completely agree. Time is precious, and to add more to the plates of the younger, but perhaps also trying to include that more into the upper levels of the academia to improve that.
Like there's stuff we can do within what we're already doing. Linda and I both teach soil science courses this semester, and we integrate more diverse perspectives in the research papers that we have our students read. And mm-hmm. we have both developed pretty good lists of papers from a wide variety of authors, researchers.
We've been talking to the first two female tenured soil scientists here at the University of Wyoming. We have Karen Vaughn and Linda Von Diepen. Thank you guys so much for chatting with us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, it's been great to talk a little bit more about these particular topics. Thanks.
When we come back, this summer's weather has prompted many in the state to rethink their thoughts about air conditioning. This is Open Spaces.
One thing we're proud of here at Wyoming Public Media is our podcasts. Whether you're looking for a good story from human nature,
I was convinced some of them are going to die,
or you want to hear our region in unexpected ways through the modern West.
When women teach women, we're saving relationships one cast at a time.
We've got a whole world waiting for you online. Explore under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. For many, opening up your windows at night used to be plenty to keep your house cool during the summertime. But extreme heat from climate change has made that more complicated. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen reports.
This is Alex Hernandez's first summer living in Denver. She moved in the spring from Wyoming, and one of the biggest adjustments has been dealing with the heat.
But I feel like it's just like a matter of strategy. Like you're planning your whole life around like these extreme temperatures.
For example, she isn't talking from her apartment because it's too hot. Instead, she's across the street at Finley's, where there's central air and cold beer.
It's a pub, super teeny weeny, but it's super cute.
Hernandez is one of about 230,000 Denver residents who don't have air conditioning. When temperatures reach the 90s, her apartment doesn't feel that much cooler.
I was taking 3 cold showers a day for a couple of weeks, and it didn't even feel cold.
To complicate matters, Hernandez works the night shift as a clinical lab technician, which means she has to try to schedule her sleep around the heat.
So I get home at 7:30, so I have to like try to fall asleep by 8 so I can sleep at least 5 hours before it gets hot.
The months of June and July were unusually warm all across the region. It's been a record hot summer in several of our cities, including Salt Lake, Boise, Helena, and Reno.
People who've lived here for a long time can really mark the change in how their summers have felt.
That's Grace Rink. She's with the City of Denver's office that primarily deals with climate change. Because extreme heat waves are expected to become more frequent and persistent, she says many residents are having to change the way they cool their homes. Older homes in the area weren't built with air conditioning.
Times have changed. The climate has changed. And now people do need air conditioning in their home to stay comfortable and, in many cases, frankly, just to stay safe.
In June, Rink's office released a renewable heating and cooling plan for the city. It gives residents incentives to shift from gas-powered heating appliances to all-electric heat pumps. Those provide both heating and cooling and are more environmentally friendly. But Denver isn't the Mountain West's only area that lacks air conditioning. According to federal data, more than 20% of the region's households do not use air conditioning. In Sheridan, Wyoming, when temperatures hit a record 107 degrees in June, Bob Gates says his heating and cooling business started getting calls that sounded like this.
I'm ready for AC. I haven't had it before. I've had it. We need it.
Gates has owned and operated Alpine Climate Control for nearly 30 years. He says a lot has changed. AC units have gotten more energy efficient, plus...
So the outside unit, you know, that makes all the buzzing, grinding kind of motor sound has gotten a lot quieter.
That's the sound of the most popular central air system Gates sells. And since it got hot early this summer and stayed that way, his crew of 14 has been busy installing them in houses.
And then I think, too, you know, we've seen an influx of new people to the area. And I don't know that they're used to the temperature or that they were expecting it to get this hot, maybe.
CU Boulder engineering professor John Zai says central air isn't the only option for homes in the region.
It's getting more and more popular, but it doesn't mean we need that.
Zai says other technologies are well suited to our climate. That includes passive cooling systems that don't require a lot of energy to function or be highly efficient.
An attic fan, which can draw the surrounding cool air to wash the internal warm air away from the ceiling, from the attic. That's very common.
And in the region's dry environment, Zai says a swamp or evaporative cooler can also work well. That device cools air by passing it over water, which forces evaporation and removes the latent heat. Still, Zai says there's no one-size-fits-all cooling solution. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
The COVID-19 pandemic has had a great impact on Indigenous communities. Wyoming Public Radio's Signe McAdams spoke to several tribal members at Wyoming's largest powwow this year, the Eastern Shoshone Indian Days, about what it was like to be at the grounds after a year of lockdown.
It feels really great to be back out here again. This energy, this positive vibes that it's giving, I just missed it so much, and I don't know. I think I'm just speechless that I'm here. You know, I'm just glad. I'm happy. Just positive stuff is just coming to my mind right now that everything's back to normal here. So, yeah, you know, I just really enjoy it, and glad to see the outfits dancing again. That was handmade by a lot of these people. A lot of people that traveled to be here and just to get things right and go back to normal again.
Yeah. Feels awesome though. Feel great. A lot of good medicine out there. A lot of good feelings, and just can't wait to keep doing it again.
Throughout the entire year, we haven't been able to see any of our friends or family from either, you know, around home or out of state. And this is the first time we actually get to see everybody. So it's an amazing feeling to be back here with everybody around.
It feels good because, you know, like I said, I've been doing performances, but, you know, you don't get the feel of how a powwow is, basically, because, you know, you get to see your family, your friends, the ones that you haven't seen in a long time, you know, because of quarantine and the pandemic that happened. So, you know, it feels really good to be out here and participating in this powwow again, you know, to visit and have fun again. Well, as of right now, I have performances that I do in Lander every Wednesday at 7 o'clock throughout July and August. But my next powwow would be in Lame Deer, Montana. And after that, I wouldn't be powwowing anymore because there's all these celebrations I've been canceling left and right. So my next big powwow that I would be going to would be in Rapid City, South Dakota, the Black Hills powwow.
I really don't know where I'm going to be going next. They're all fairly spaced pretty far apart and a lot of restrictions still. But as soon as I find one close enough, soon enough, I'll be heading there.
That was Signa McAdams from the Wind River Reservation speaking with Patrick Littleshield, Sam Hermany Horses, Fred Heba, and Dean Littleshield. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. You can find archives from this show and others on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. The program is also available via podcast at all the usual places. You can also find this week's segments on Facebook and the station's social media pages. Anna Rader is our digital editor. We encourage you to support our Wyoming journalism with your pledge of support today. Also, we say goodbye to our outstanding Northeastern Wyoming reporter, Catherine Wheeler, who's leaving us to become the All Things Considered host at Iowa Public Radio. She will be missed. Have a great weekend. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.